All right, this is Monday, September 26th. Thank you very much. My son turns 21 this week. Yep, it's amazing. And so let's take a look at what's going to happen. Let's see here. I believe there's some homework due today. Is that correct? On sapling, that's the word, yes. I should send out an email notice of that. Then we're also having another little quiz, is that correct, on Thursday, right? Two of them, actually, but they're all relatively straightforward, the fatty acid oxidation ones. Fatty acid oxidation and ketone body thing, that actually has my favorite enzyme in it, beta oxidation of saturated fatty acids. It's got my favorite enzyme in it. So because it does amazing things with, that's it. My favorite, no, that's the synthesis. Let's see, the oxidation is backed up a little bit right there. This enzyme right there. Oh, this one, actually. You just leave it. Acyl-CoA dehydrogenase, my favorite enzyme, because it does wonderful organic chemistry. Hopefully, in your experience, you'll pick out a favorite enzyme, too. At any rate, so what we're going to do is Thursday, what I'd like to do is do a couple things that are inconvenient anywhere else. That is, of course, we'll have a little quiz, which will not take very long. And then I'd like to go over the old test one, on that same day. And so that way, what?
On Thursday,
yeah. Thursday is what I'm talking about. And so the quiz, and then we'll go over the test. That way we don't have to, if we can squeeze it in quickly, which we can, I believe, we won't have to take any time in the evenings and stuff. That'll help me. We've got a very, very busy week this week. Of course, we've got alumni coming up. On Friday, we're having a Vespers. The chemistry department's having a Vespers this week, right after the alumni parade. There'll be haystacks. Sign up if you wish. Come. It'll be out at the AFM complex there on St. Joseph River in the main lodge. So it'll be very nice. We'll have a fireplace going. The fire in the fireplace and haystacks and some good fellowship and good food. If you want to come, please sign up by Wednesday, if you don't mind, so we can figure out how much food we should bring. Homework again is due tonight about 10. I'll probably assign six. Six should be done. I'll start working on 7. Chapter 7 is... hemoglobin, and we should get to that without any trouble today, so certainly. Let's take a look then at any questions you might have. What questions might you have about the class so far? Anything? Anything at all? Questions, concerns, comments? If you have them, email them to me. If you don't feel like seeing them in public, come and see me. I mean, if you want true anonymity, you're welcome to email them to Dana Johnston. It's danaj@andrews.edu, and she'll type them up or strip off any identifying information and send them on to me, and so you can make comments anonymously if you wish. And so if there's anything along that line you want to say, please go right ahead. Anxious to be able to accommodate whatever concerns you might have. Let's begin with a word of prayer today. Thank you, Lord, for the rain that's come. Thank you for the opportunities to were afforded to us over the week of spiritual emphasis last week, that we can gain a new perspective, our own spiritual growth. We ask now, as we look forward to the next couple weeks before the fall break, that we can focus our minds, our bodies, and our talents on gaining the information and the understanding and the attitudes that would help us be successful in all of our classes, and that we may find that as we approach the middle of the semester, that we are continuing to strengthen our ability to learn, our rapidity with which we learn, that we may find success as we go to the next level of classes and work in graduate school. We ask that you be with our family and friends today. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. All right. So, true or false, all proteins spontaneously fold correctly because of the imperative of the hydrophobic interactions of the protein structure. All proteins spontaneously fold correctly. True or false? What's the answer, of course? False. That is, in fact, false. And so if they are not, if that's not done spontaneously through the information found in their sequence, what must happen? Well, it turns out, discovered about 20 years ago, are these heat shock proteins. Why are they called heat shock proteins in the bacteria? Why are they called heat shock proteins? They are found predominantly at higher temperatures. That's exactly correct. In other words, they expose the bacteria to a little increase in heat. Not enough to kill them, but stressed them out with a little heat and looked at the proteins that are being manufactured and discovered a whole set they had no idea existed. What? Where'd these come from? And as they began to examine them after they discovered them, they discovered that they were purposed to restore the correct folding for certain proteins. And so they got a whole different, a whole set of a whole set of nomenclature with that. And it all began in the 80s. Of course, these are called molecular chaperones. Molecular chaperones. Of course, what is this? You can understand why they call it that. And apparently there are essential proteins that bind unfolded, partially folded proteins, assist in proper folding, prevent premature aggregation and precipitation. How would that work? Why does an unfolded protein precipitate? It interacts with other proteins. Why do unfolded proteins, good question, good response, exactly correct. Why do unfolded proteins interact with other proteins? Because of non-covalent interactions. Now, you could also say, now, what are the non-covalent interactions we've talked about? Van der Waals, hydrophobic, although I think that's probably, Van der Waals hydrophobic is sort of the same thing. And then what else? Ionic and? Hydrogen bonding. Yeah, exactly. The salt bridges and so on. Of those three, or four, you would certainly say that the ionic interactions are pretty strong. Of course, there are other ions typically in the solution. So what actually happens is it's the hydrophobic interactions that come together. If you had two oil droplets floating on the surface of the water, I have no idea what this is. If you had two oil droplets floating on the surface of the water, as they approach each other, if they touch, would they coalesce into a larger droplet? Yeah. Because as a larger droplet, they have a little less surface area for the volume. And when, because of the little less surface area because of the volume, then they actually, the coalescing increases the randomness of the bulk water around that, around the surface of the oil-water interface right there. As these coalesce, the amount of entropy in the bulk water actually increases, and that's the driving force of causing that coalescing to occur. Well, if you take that same idea where oil droplets coalesce, you end up having a situation where these exposed proteins that are unfolded have these sections that are primarily hydrophobic. And they actually then, as they approach each other, the two unfolding ones unfold, as they kind of coalesce, as does an oil droplet. And as they aggregate into larger and larger pieces, they become too heavy, too big to maintain solubility, and they drop out of solution. All right, so what are these heat shock proteins? HPSC 70 monomers, chaperones, large multi-subunit proteins, HPSC signal transduction, protein folding. In other words, they've discovered that they have a whole family of heat shock proteins, the details of which are beyond the scope of our examination today, and are all designed to fold these proteins. So the trigger factor associates with ribosomes for improper folding of new synthesized proteins. So there is a pre-chaperone kind of a thing like there, all known are ATPases, which means they use energy to do the folding. And best known are the E. coli chaperonins, GRO-L and GRO-S. GRO-L and GRO-S. And if here you see a GRO-L and GRO-S combined together, and, oh my goodness, look at it's a multi-subunit protein that has a tremendous complexity involved with it. It has an inner core. It's about 10 angstroms wide, if you include the cap. And what happens is the GRO-L and the GRO-S combine to have this kind of interaction to make the protein folded. So let's see here how this would work. So what I need for you to do is pay attention to this. This diagram right here will substitute for a lot of reading in the textbook. Well, not substitute it, but certainly helps it. And so we need to go through this pretty quickly and see what happens. So let's start here with, and it, notice here you have this is sort of the end of the situation where you have a properly folded protein right here, and although it's got step one here is up here, but it almost seems to work a little better starting down here. They've got a properly folded protein. You've got the GRO-S and the GRO-L combined, and you at the bottom begin to input a improperly folded protein, and you move from a set of unbound proteins that do not contain ATP to a set of proteins that do contain ATP, and they begin to allow the protein to enter in through the bottom here. The GRO-S falls off, ATP is hydrolyzed, and this better folded protein, but it may not have to be purely correctly folded. Sometimes it has to go through there more than once, they've discovered, is ejected, and this allows the improperly folded protein to move up into the interior. There is a turn of approximately 180 degrees. The subunits turn relative to each other, approximately 180 degrees, and this allows then the protein to shift and move. The GRO-S comes back on, and then there is another shift, a hydrolysis of ATP, physically moving that protein into a better shape, and then this hydrolysis then creates that better shape. Another protein comes in, ATP is added, the better protein falls off, the GRO-S falls off, and then you've got this turn again that moves the protein up into a different section. The GRO-S comes on. It is a complicated interaction. The idea there is that here are the bottom line ideas that come out of this graph. One is that there is the chaperonins are ATPases, as I mentioned here. That's one big idea. Next big idea is the subunits physically move relative to each other as they attempt to fold the protein appropriately. Another big idea is that the GRO-S and GRO-L have to be connected in order for that to occur, and that the GRO-S and the GRO-L separate as the better folded protein is ejected. So it's a multi-step process with the hydrolysis of enormous amounts of ATP, with the subunits moving relative to each other, that causes, and they still don't know exactly how, the protein to actually move, the unfolded protein or misfolded protein, to move and adjust into the proper folding. This occurs on a protein more than once, or can occur more than once. So that's the whole idea behind molecular chaperones. They're called heat shock proteins. Each family has its own particular purpose. It uses lots of ATP, multi-subunit. The subunits move relative to each other, and that it can cause, it may have to be done more than once. All right, so are improperly folded proteins a health problem? Oh yeah, they certainly are. There are at least 20 diseases thought to be caused by improperly folded proteins. The first blank is 20. The next blank is called PPTS, which of course precipitates. PPTS stands for precipitates. Amyloids is the next blank. Fourth blank is called Alzheimer's, ALZ HEIMERS. That's the fourth blank. Fifth blank is called prions. And the last blank is TSE, capital T, capital S, capital E. All right, so at least 20 diseases are thought to be caused by misfolded proteins. Some of them very, very naughty diseases. Very naughty diseases. And their misfolding, not unusually, would cause precipitates. And these precipitates are called amyloids. You sometimes hear them called amyloid. Begins with a P. I don't know if anybody heard it. What? No. Amyloid plaques. Plaques. Like what you get on your teeth. Plaque. Amyloid plaques. That's what they have the word right there. So the Alzheimer's form these amyloid beta plaques. And so as these plaques begin to build up in the brain, the nerve functioning deteriorates and memory, long-term potentiation, is lost. They're still not sure exactly the nature of how Alzheimer's occurs. It's wonderful, actually, that we have Alzheimer's. It's actually pretty spectacular that guys are dying of... I'm taking a contrarian point of view in this. Because we get prostate cancer. Guys, what is it, 50% of men over 70 have prostate cancer? So why am I saying something so stupid? Well, because both prostate cancer and Alzheimer's are a disease of what? Yes, but in a general aspect, old people. Old people. Guess what the age of death? I just was reminded of this morning, this weekend. In 1903, 1911, what was the average age of death in the United States? 42 was when people were dying. The average age of death. And guess who lived longer, men or women? Men did. Women were dying at 38. Average age of death. Yeah, because of childbirth. What happens if you have a too big a baby going through your birth canal? What do you do? What do you have? What happens when you try to do that? I mean, how do they rescue the mother and the baby? C-section, right. Did they do C-sections in 1908, 1903? No. What happened to the baby? Died. What happened to the woman? Died because of infection. It would take 3 or 4 days, sometimes a week, to die with a woman that had too big of a baby coming through. So, in the meantime, because of modern medicine, the birth date, and it was not unusual for a man to have 3 or 4 wives because of the mother, you know, they die in childbirth, they die early. Now it's switched around, and then men are not living as long as women, and women, you know, because of getting through the childbirth age. So the fact that we have, did they have Alzheimer's back then? Not in the general population, perhaps those rare individuals that lived in the 60s, but not normally. All right, so spongiform, transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, TSEs, prions. Now, that's a little different than the Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's has a different cause than these TSEs do. And of course, prions are these durable proteins that initiate misfolding in other proteins. And misfolded proteins, similar to other misfolded proteins, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which is a disease that's linked particularly to Eastern European Jews, along with a couple other diseases, is that. So you have Alzheimer's, amyloid beta protein, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, superoxide dismutase. Anybody know what that is? It's abbreviated ALS. It's also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. That's correct. Huntington's disease. Now, this Huntington's disease is particularly naughty because you can do a genetics test with them, and they begin to lose their minds in their mid-40s. And you can almost predict with almost 100% certainty that based on, it's a genetic disease. People get it from their, from their ancestors. And they can predict almost to within a few years of when you're going to start losing your mind. It's an interesting thing. Of course, Parkinson's disease, they think it's that. And the TSE is the prion protein. You do not need to memorize this list, only in the aspect that, don't even memorize the list. Don't worry about it. I'm not going to ask any questions over it. Let's go on, shall we, ladies and gentlemen? And do you have chapter 7 available to you? What chapters are available on Moodle?
Up to 9,
that's correct. So we have quite a ways yet to go. Now we're going to be looking at myoglobin, hemoglobin, oxygen carrying capacity. So it's a fantastic set of... you have seen some of this, of course, in other classes, especially if you've taken systems phys, perhaps certainly in general biology. Did you guys in foundations do anything with hemoglobin? Quite a bit? Yeah, okay. So it's a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, but it's still there. Let's take a look at some what we're going to look at overall. There's actually only 3 blanks on the second page of the handout. They are near the bottom. The first one is called oxygen. The next one is called heme. And the third one is called globin. Globin, 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 globin. What's going on here? I just noticed that there was only one going on. All right, so in this section, and there's only like 15 slides in it, we're going to go through a lot of very intense graphics. And you're going to have to learn how to interpret those intense graphics and apply them to answer questions. This is a very, fairly intense chapter in terms of critical thinking skills. But first of all, we're going to look at the myoglobin structure and then its oxygen binding curve, then hemoglobin and its oxygen binding curve, the idea of cooperativity, the mechanism of cooperativity, how the porphyrin changes, what these T-R or TR state transformations are, and the allosteric modifiers of the behavior of hemoglobin. And then we'll take a look at the review of the 4 levels of protein structure within the hemoglobin. All right, so we're going to take a look at myoglobin. Myo in this case means what? Muscle globin. Why do you have myoglobin in your muscles? Why do you have... Obviously, it's to do what? Trap oxygen and then also help transport it. Why do you need help transporting oxygen? Why can't you just breathe it in and let it dissolve into your serum and let it and transport it to your different parts of your body? Boom. What's a fundamental rule about the concentration of gases in liquids? What's going to have a higher concentration of dissolved gases, warm water or cold water? Cold water. In other words, the saturation of gases in liquids are inversely proportional to its temperature. Warmer temperatures mean you have less gas. Are you warm-blooded? Yes. It's because of hemoglobin that the concentration of oxygen in your blood is nearly approximately the same concentration as in the air. But because you're warm-blooded, you couldn't do that unless you had a transport protein. Now, if you were a fish, now they do have hemoglobin as well, but again, that has to do with size considerations. Trout. Where do you find trout? Cold water. Guess what kind of fish needs a relatively high concentration of oxygen? Trout. Where do you find catfish? Warm water at the bottom. And are they slow moving? Yeah, they're just going along, picking up, eating crap off, pardon my language, but it's true, eating refuse off the bottom of the lake. All right. I wouldn't eat catfish if I were you. But at any rate, they're slow moving. Their oxygen demands are relatively much less than trout, and so they can survive in warmer water. All right, so that's why you even have to have all this stuff. That's why you have to have muscle hemoglobin. It's not enough for hemoglobin to drop the oxygen off in near your muscle tissue, but in order to maintain high concentrations of oxygen in your muscle tissue, you have to have this myoglobin. Now, myoglobin is a monomer and behaves completely different than the tetramer hemoglobin. Oxygen transport in rapidly respiring cells of muscle tissue and other tissues. Okay? So, how does myoglobin actually transport oxygen? It's trapped in the cell. It's not being moved. So how does myoglobin actually transport these things? Well, you've heard of a bucket brigade. Anybody know what a bucket brigade is? Yeah. What? That's right. Lots of buckets, and they'd stand in one spot, and the water would be transported to them, and they'd move it like this. Well, a myoglobin in your cell is just like a bucket brigade, okay? So you are going to be a hemoglobin. Now notice the nice oblong structure here. Reminds me of an oxygen molecule, doesn't it? Two oxygens bound together, is that right? Okay, hold on to this. I'm going to go on the other end. She's hemoglobin. She's a transporter protein. You guys are now in... This is a muscle cell. This central section is a muscle cell, okay? You four, five right in here are myoglobin molecules, okay? And I'm right over here, I'm a mitochondria, short and stout. And here's my double membrane, and here's my Christie. Never mind, it's an old joke. That's not old at all. Now, I need oxygen because I need to produce what? ATP, because I'm being signaled, I need to move because my owner is running after the pizza truck because the pizza wasn't delivered correctly, okay? Went to the wrong room, and they're taking the pizza back, and blah, blah, blah. So I'm running after the pizza truck. I need my oxygen. But the oxygen's way over there at the hemoglobin in the circulatory system. The hemoglobin drops off the oxygen, and it diffuses across the membrane to all these myoglobin molecules. Did the myoglobin molecules move? No. All they did was do a what kind of thing? Bucket brigade to me, where I got to use this. And now I've made it into water and oxygen and ATP. All right. Oxygen transport in rapidly respiring cells of mouth tissue and other tissues, mostly muscle. Ferroprotoporphyrin, there's a wide variety of numbers of those. The protein unit is called the globin. Okay, you can take your either hand, I don't care, make it like this. Make your one hand like this. Thank you very much. Flatten out your other hand like this. This is the globin. This is the heme. You stick one in like that, bingo, guess what you got? Hemoglobin, or at least the myoglobin. You'd have four of these, four units just like this, connected together to make a hemoglobin. But that's exactly what happens. There's a crevice right in here. The bulk of the globin surrounds this crevice, and inside that crevice is this flat organic molecule that contains an iron ligand that fits inside there. And notice, if you would, because it's open up here, it has access to the environment, and that's where oxygen comes in and binds to that globin, to the heme unit. So you can see here, you've got this flat-like unit. You got the iron 2 there. There's the oxygen right there. There is another bond down to this particular unit right here. Anybody recognize that side chain? What is it? Histidine, and she says with tremendous confidence. Histidine? Histidine? Thank you very much. Histidine. Histidine. Now, what am I just repeating? Histidine. Histidine right there. Count the number of bonds. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And when oxygen presents, there's what? 6. Correct. Notice here, on this flat porphyrin ring, you've got areas here that have polar groups. You've got areas here that are nonpolar groups. Which, how do you think this orients itself within the globin protein? How do you think that orients itself? You got this thing sticking like this and sticks in here. The fingertips are buried inside. Which ones do you think are going to be buried inside? The nonpolar end or the polar end or polar side of that ring? Yeah, exactly right. Sticks in here like this. And then there's a connection between one knuckle and the other knuckle up here. And then you got... So, but is that a permanent connection, that oxygen right there? Is that a permanent connection between here and there? No. So the number of bonds to nitrogen in this whole structure varies between 5 and 6. Between 5 when oxygen is not present and 6 when oxygen is. That sixth oxygen or that sixth ligand changes the coordination of that iron. And so what happens is, and I'll this actually has import later, so just hold on. But under normal circumstances, what happens when there's 5 bonds, the heme is actually not flat, it's cone-shaped, where your middle knuckle right here is that iron. The heme has a bulge when there's only 5 things attached to it. Okay? When oxygen attaches to it, a sixth ligand, the bonds foreshorten and it flattens straight out. The iron sinks into the ring. Sinks into the ring. Okay? It's domed without the oxygen present. It's perfectly flat when it is. That movement is approximately 6/10 of an angstrom. I've seen other measurements being different than that, but that's the measurement I use. Now, does anybody recognize this structure in general as being someplace else? Has God reused this structure? If I would substitute the iron out and put in a magnesium, what would I get? Chlorophyll. Exactly correct. If I substitute this structure out, the structure is a little different, but it's pretty close to this. I substitute this structure out and put in a cobalt. I have the fundamental structure of vitamin B12. Yep. Vitamin B12. So God likes that structure. Okay. You know, he found something he likes. He's not stupid. He's not going to have to reinvent the wheel every time. He just does it over again. So, same structure. Now, there's some modifications, of course. It's not identical, but the same idea is there chemically, in which you have nitrogen's providing bonding to the iron here, and or magnesium, and you can have some tremendous powerful effects from that. But I mean, it's just remarkable that the essence of this is simply designed to carry oxygens. Put a magnesium in there, and you got chlorophyll. It's designed to capture energy and release electrons. Amazing. Let's go ahead. Now, a little bit of mathematics, not much. Let's go down the bottom here. Okay. Now, the first blank here is called dissociation. Next blank is called fractional saturation. Fractional. There's actually only four blanks on this page. Dissociation, fractional saturation. The next one is P50. And the last one is 50%. 50%. So, going to have you do a little mind melding, a little mind thinking here, ladies and gentlemen. That is, you got the following. We're going to set up a little mathematical constant here just to help us understand what's going on, to make some predictions. And we have myoglobin plus oxygen yields oxygen and myoglobin, MbO2. They're going to write this in a slightly different way. Notice this is reactants over products. This is known as a dissociation constant, as opposed to what most chemists use, as it says here, which is an association constant, which is products over reactants. So here we're doing this slightly differently, a dissociation constant, reactants over products. You will not have to relearn any of your fundamentals of general chemistry or even organic chemistry, but just an interesting way of looking at it. And so you have the K for this is reactants over products, the concentration of myoglobin times the concentration of oxygen all over the binary form of that. So that gives us one way of finding out what that K is, some constant, some value that we could use at a particular temperature to predict what these various concentrations are over a range of oxygen concentrations. They now then can look at something known as a fractional saturation. So just put this K on hold, pause, hit the pause button, put that on hold, and then go on to this next idea. So we're actually now talking about a second idea. The second idea here is something known as fractional saturation, YO2. YO2, and that is, how many of the sites contain oxygen out of all of the sites that are available? That's fractional saturation. How many sites contain oxygen out of all the sites that are available? Okay? Now, all the sites that are available in this case include the ones that are not oxygenated plus the ones that are oxygenated. Those are all the sites that are available. Unoxygenated and oxygenated, total number of sites. You then divide that into, you sum that up and divide that into the total number of oxygenated sites, and you get this fractional saturation, YO2. It's a very common phrase. You're going to see it a lot in standardized tests. You'll see it also in other forms, other binding ideas use this fractional saturation or fractional binding. So you need to keep it in mind when you look at this. Please remember the idea of fractional saturation, not only for oxygen, but for other compounds. Okay, following the algebra in the text, which we will not do here, ultimately fractional saturation can be modeled by the equation. Right, YO2 equals the partial pressure of oxygen, all divided by this K constant, which you find up here, plus the partial pressure of oxygen. Now, again, this K up here. This O2 is based on this definition, and we can resolve it down to something that gives us Once you find some K value for a particular temperature of this oxygen binding, you can simply look at the partial pressure of oxygen and see how much is going to be bound to the protein. So the K can be operationally defined as the partial pressure of oxygen at which Y is equal to 0.5. It's also called P50. Can also be defined as the oxygen pressure which myoglobin is 50% saturated. So the K, I mean, you can have a wide variety of K values, but essentially it's the value of the partial pressure of oxygen at which the Y is half. Okay? Also called P50, partial pressure at 50% saturation. Okay? Oxygen pressure, which P50. So you're going to find that K value, also called P50. So you could write this same equation down, and you will see it in that. I want you to be prepared where it comes from. YO2, the fractional saturation of oxygen, is equal to the partial pressure of oxygen, all divided by P50, divided by the partial pressure of oxygen. YO2 equals PO2 all over P50 plus PO2. PO2. So these two equations here, this one and this one, are the exact same equation. You're liable to see it more likely than like this. And with the K, this is much more specific for oxygen capacity. All right, let's go ahead. Now, if you notice, this equation right here provides an interesting and particular kind of curve, as we'll see here. Let me go to the bottom. Bump, 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 bump. Okay, there we go. First blank. It's called 100 tor. This is overhead 4. Next blank is called 30 tor. Next blank is called relays. Relays. That's what I call the bucket brigade, is a relay. This is a direct quote from your text. Hyperbola. Hyperbola. Hyperbola is the next blank. Now then, next series of blanks begins to looking at the structure of hemoglobin. The first blank under that section is just has a single letter, capital D. Next blank is alpha sub 2, beta sub 2. Alpha sub 2, beta sub 2. The next blank under that is 15 degrees. 15 degrees. And the next blank under that is called deoxy. Deoxy. And the final blank on the extreme right-hand lower corner of the overhead is the oxy form. The oxy form. Okay. Now, let's take a look at what we're looking at here. Do you ever go outside and you see a beautiful blue sky with puffy clouds and the air is fresh and it just smells great, and you just take a deep breath just to fill your oxygens with some of the best air ever? You ever do that? I know I do. Oh, I do that all the time here because we've got great air here, despite Chicago being close. But when you breathe that in, it turns out that in the arterial blood that's being pumped to the rest of your body through your lung, after the lungs, the partial pressure of oxygen in there is about 100 tor. Okay. Once it comes back from your blood, it comes back from your big toe, comes back from your liver, it's about 30 tor in partial pressure of oxygen. But oddly enough, even at 30 tor, your myoglobin is almost fully saturated. If here is the oxygen binding curve for myoglobin. You can recognize the curve as being myoglobin because it's a what? Hyperbola. When you see an oxygen binding curve that's hyperbola, the one molecule you think of is myoglobin. You never think of hemoglobin, only myoglobin. All right, so notice here, they go up this vertical graph, that YO2 stands for the what? Fractional saturation. That's exactly correct. Fractional saturation. Fractional saturation is where? That's half. We follow the half saturation over here to the line. We drop it down on your graph, on your overhead. Write in what you think that number is right there. What do you think that number is? Was it? 2.5, exactly. 2.5 TOR. 2.5 TOR, right there, 2.5 TOR. Now, so that means these five, I'm going to make six. I'm going to come over here and make six. All right, so I'm in, you guys are all in a muscle cell. These six of us here are myoglobin molecules. All right, so myoglobin. In order for three of us to have oxygen and three of us not, what must be the partial pressure of oxygen in our environment? What must it be? 2.5. If our fractional saturation is 50% at partial pressure of 2.5 TOR, that means at 2.5 TOR, half of them have oxygen, and what? The other half don't. Sometimes I feel like an oxygen, sometimes I don't. Do you ever hear of a Mr.? Oh, never mind. Sometimes I feel like a nut, sometimes I don't. You ever heard that advertising song or jingle? Okay, good. Sometimes I... But, ladies and gentlemen, out here is in the vein. You have a vein. You're so vain. You probably think this song is about you. What is the partial pressure of oxygen out here? In the vein. What is it? 30 TOR. You come all the way up here to 30 TOR, and guess what the fractional saturation of myoglobin is at 30 TOR? 90%. That means in reality, that most muscle cells, okay, if the vein, that means after the oxygen is delivered, is 30 TOR, that means the vast majority of myoglobin in a cell, is it oxygenated or unoxygenated? Oxygenated. Over 90% is oxygenated. So all you guys have oxygen, you're holding on to oxygen. All right? You have an oxygen. All right? I'm suddenly now a mitochondria. I need that oxygen. What immediately happens as soon as she loses that oxygen? Boom. It immediately gets filled up again. The bucket brigade is extraordinarily efficient at moving oxygen from the surface of the cell into the interior because it's always filled with oxygen. There's always oxygen there. All right, enough of that. Myoglobin, what word do I use here? Efficiently relays oxygen from the capillaries to the muscle cells because it's always filled with oxygen. Okay? So as soon as one oxygen used up, there's more to fill it in. It's not like, you know, she has to yell down here, "Hey, I need oxygen," and this guy wakes up and goes, "Hey, okay, no." This, you know, it's always there. Okay, let's take a look at hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is very similar. I want to back the truck up here, see if this... one of the things I want to show here before we go on is the structure of myoglobin. What we're going to do here is I want you to see, look at this, we'll refer back. I'm now looking at overhead number 2, and I got to get done in 3 seconds, 4 seconds. Do you see any beta sheets here? You see any beta sheets? No. The main secondary structure here is what? Alpha helices. It starts down here with carbon number 1. It ends over here with carbon number, let's see here, where is this? That's a 153. Yeah, see, that's the N. That's the nitrogen N on the A, and that's the on the A A alpha helix, and this is the carboxy end on the that's the H helix on the C terminus end. Notice it's nothing but alpha helices. It goes A, B, C, D, E. D is literally a tube looking right at you in this drawing. E, F, G, H. Boom, 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 boom. And last point, I've got to make it, sorry, is this. Hemoglobin's all alpha helices. Hemoglobin, the individual subunits, are all alpha helices, but they do not contain a D. They do not contain a D. So, in myoglobin, it goes A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Okay. Hemoglobin, it goes A, B, C, E, F, G, H. Well, actually, they all went to H. But if the A matches the A, the B matches the B, the C matches the C, but for some reason there's no D in the three-dimensional structure. At any rate, I'll leave that to your curiosity. We'll talk about that more tomorrow. Have a great day.
As old as time, true as it can be, barely even friends, then somebody bends unexpectedly. Just a little change, small to say the least. Both a little scared, neither one prepared. Beauty and the Beast. Ever just the same, ever a surprise. Ever as before, ever just as sure as the sun will rise. As old as time, tune as old as song, bitter, sweet, and strange, finding you can change, learning you were wrong. Certain as the sun, rising in the east, tale as old as time. Song as old as rhyme, Beauty and the Beast. Tale as old as time, song as old as rhyme, Beauty and the Beast. Off to the cupboard with you now, Chip. It's past your bedtime. Good night, love.